And I got to the end of myself. Again, I've never met anybody that had the experience I've had. And so I don't know what to say about that. I just felt like I got struck by lightning. And for almost 2 hours, the pain and suffering that drove me to be up there with the rope fixing to hang myself was pushed out of me from the bottom of my feet to the top of my head like a syringe. But I'll tell you what came in, and what always has the power is hope for the future.
Hello and welcome, everyone. I am Jory Calkins, the founder and CEO of Enduring Companies and the host of Built to Outlast, a podcast and community for business builders by business builders. We explore the journeys and companies of business builders in America with a focus on traditional small to mid-sized business niches and the strategies which enable them to endure and flourish. If you are building a business now or aspire to build one in the future, this is for you. To join the Built to Outlast community and access episodes, show notes, and other community resources to support your journey, please visit builttooutlast.com. If you have or know a business that may be sold and care who the buyer is, or if you want to buy or build a business and care who you do it with, please visit enduring.co to learn more about us, our long-term approach, and our holding company. Welcome, everyone, for our show today. We're speaking with John Marsh, who's a friend and the host of the Redemptification Podcast, as well as the co-founder of the Marsh Collective, which stewards over $1.5 billion of real estate in small American towns. John, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's great to be here. You know, I love talking to you. I just get smarter hanging out with you.
I don't know about that, but I do enjoy our conversations, and I appreciate you spending the time with me today. I'd love to start at some of this. I will be maybe new and learning for me. It always is in these conversations, but wherever you're comfortable starting and would like to start with your kind of story and journey, if that's, you know, day one or year one or month one or five, who are you? Where did you come from? What serves as kind of the foundation for you and the life that you've been building?
Well, I'll start back at just a little context to understand kind of where I'm coming from. My mom had tried for 13 years to have a child, couldn't have one. They adopted me, and 18 months later had my little brother. So my mom said, all I ever want to be was a mama. So she was a stay-at-home mom. She said, I quit my job the day I found out you were coming, and I never went back to work until y'all were gone. And she just loved that. She just wanted to be a mom. She just loved that, loved raising us. Great growing up, did everything my parents said, A, B, honor roll, until I stepped across the line at 13 years old and did things that I thought I couldn't get my parents to forgive me or even God to forgive me for, and stepped across the line and slept with a young girl who was 12. She was my girlfriend. And for both of us, that rebellion, we kind of started on a journey of rebellion after that. Never had a real job. 14 years old, I did an apprenticeship in the high-end audio business. And by 15, I'd started my own business. After school, I'd install high-end car audio and behind my friend's shop and making $1,000 a week in cash. And I thought I'd won the lottery. I mean, I was making more than the teachers at our school. And so I just started building things. High-end audio moved me here and then moved us into the actual automobile business. We were in the salvage business. We bought totaled Land Cruisers, Tundras, Sequoias, and the Lexus SUVs, totaled and fixed them and rebuilt them and sold them with salvage titles that are rebuilt. Did that for 12 years. During that time, we also started other businesses. And one thing I began to realize is money and girls were the two things where I found I'd longed for acceptance and always wondered if I was accepted. But those things made me feel accepted in such a huge way that I was drawn to success because of if you're successful with girls, we know what that is. And if you're successful with money, we know what that is. And so, as a young man, that drew me in. And to be honest with you, all I could think about was being successful. I mean, it was a death. I'll either die or try this. And it was because my identity was so woven up in that activity.
This is like a minute into the conversation. And there's so much that I want to learn more about already. So this might be a 10-hour 10-hour episode. If you're up for it, I'd love to take kind of each of those a little bit piece by piece in terms of you know, you and your brother growing up. So geographically, I know you're in
Albany, Georgia,
in Alabama now.
Yeah, Albany, Georgia, okay, Georgia. Which is the pecan capital of the world. I grew up, my dad was an electrical contractor. My mom was stay at home. I learned the electrical business some through my dad, just him tinkering in the yard or me watching him. My brother's a master electrician still. I was supposed to take over the family business and I was just too hard-headed. I never wanted a job. And so I've never really had one. I've woke up and basically unemployed every day for all these years, in a sense. I mean, just charging hell with a squirt bottle and whatever it was I'm really interested in. So this follow your passion thing, it can work. But boy, there's some side consequences to doing that. And so what I think was interesting, though, is if you look back from car audio to rebuilding cars to the restaurant business, we started over 60 businesses, 6-0. In our marriage over 31 years. We just celebrated 31 years just a few weeks ago.
Congrats.
And one thing I've learned is that being entrepreneurially promiscuous is something that that can be incredibly impactful in getting things started. But the stages of either, you know, launching and startup, stabilization, and then growth and improvement, I have to be a different leader at each stage, and I didn't understand that looking back. So we just run continuous startups. When my 5 years ago in our businesses, we made a transition, and we'll talk about that in a little bit, where Ash took over the 14 companies that were that we owned at that time. And what she's done has been incredible. And what it showed me is I don't compete with other giftings. The ideal world is I complete them. They complete me. We work together. And we can talk a little bit about those gifting things. So we went up to the cars to this car salvage business, and that ended up. I was 20 something years old. I was 23 years old. I was been married just a year or two. We had a little boy. I was $1.5 million in debt. I was $99,000 overdrawn, and I was hooked on meth. Went to the attic of my house to hang myself, and got transformed. Now, my wife had left me for one of our employees who happened to be one of our banker's sons, and my whole life fell apart. And I kept hearing, kill yourself, take your life, take your life. And as this is something that I've realized in a lot of entrepreneurs, this type of work can have such incredible impacts and stress on us that many people get to the place to say, hey, I'd be better off if I took my own life. And I believe that thing is a lie, and it almost took me and my family out. So know that these gifts you have or these businesses you start, for everything you own, owns a piece of you. And if you start having a lot of trouble in them, losing a business can almost feel like losing a child or a loved one.
I'd love to, if you're willing, go deeper on this and maybe in particular some of the feelings you were having, because I don't think you're alone. I'm sure you felt and in that instance, you know, we're feeling very alone.
I did. But I didn't have any solutions. And I think that this life I'm living for me that wasn't worth living actually was the right thing to understand. Like, it was right that I needed to change. But the question is, do you have hope in your future? Because if you have hope in your future, you have power in your present. If there's no hope, if you're hopeless, the reason I wanted to take my own life is because I believed that the best of my life had already passed by and that everything in the future was going to be worse than what was in the past. And that's a hopeless place. And so at that point, we were $1.5 million in debt, $99,000 overdrawn. I get struck by lightning. My life is transformed. I have this very unique experience, but my wife hasn't had it. So she continues to not want to be with me for almost a year as I try to build the skills to be a good husband. And it took us 6 or 7 years. We reconciled, but to truly love one another and find one another took a lot of time. So as entrepreneurs, if you think this isn't going to impact your marriage, you're insane. You are insane. They've strapped themselves to the Unabomber if you get in a mess. I mean, this thing is difficult. And everything that happens in your business life, if you don't watch it, feels like it's your identity. It's not happening, you know, around you, it is you, and that's very painful.
Yeah, yeah. No, we're the only ones who can see each other on video, but I'm vigorously shaking my head in agreement that. And this conversation isn't about me, but I've had not dissimilar experiences in terms of tying self-worth to, in particular, business outcomes, and, you know, feeling the real risk that those might not turn out the way that I had always hoped that they turn out. I'd love to talk about, maybe before we jump deeper into that, what was it that drew you to kind of being the captain of your own ship, whether that was at age, I don't know, 12, you know, your early teens, you know, when you started
seeing my dad
doing electronics.
My dad was a self-employed man, and he just talked to me a lot about, he valued like working for himself and doing excellent work and having this autonomy. Like he said, son, if I'm going to lose money on a job, I can just write him a check and go fishing. I mean, I have an opportunity. And for me, it was just, to be honest with you, I never considered getting a job. I just saw it as a task you do for income, but it didn't have a passion and a connection hook to it. And so I just, we paid a huge price. I mean, it's not free. I mean, we paid a price in our marriage. We paid a price financially. We paid a lot of prices. Now, there's been a great, great price, but the prize has been good. Like down the road, we're a 25-year overnight success. You know, as we were our first, so our kind of, we went through the this audio business, then the salvage business and salvage yard. Then we went through restaurant business and started doing structures, historic houses, because I said, hey, houses and cars, it's about the same thing. One's got plumbing, one drives down the road, same parts just about. And so we started fixing junky old houses, which no one else wanted to do. The first house we bought, I think, in our town was like $5,500, the worst neighborhood in town. And so we found these skill sets. And one thing I've learned is like, and this is jumping forward, but like most of the guys on our construction crews, one of our companies is still construction. I would say there's only one guy on that crew that had really previous construction experience. Everything else we brought out of other industries. They may have been an auto mechanic, or they may have been in high-end audio or something. We would look for skill sets and bring them over, because what we realized, the difference in working on a new house and an old house is the difference on working on a new Land Cruiser and a 70s Nova. I mean, it's just completely different, right? And what most people do in the real estate world, in the development world, is go get the new Lexus guy or Land Cruiser guy to come try to fix their Nova. And they're like, well, throw it away. Well, no, we can't throw it away. Well, it's going to cost you five times as much. That's what happens. And it's because of this wrong mindset. So we found that there's transferable skill sets. And we started personality testing our people and doing this. And that came over time. But we learned, hey, there's all kind of genius in other industries that our guys may think this job sucks, but somebody else will go, that is a cakewalk. It's way better than changing rear end fluid in a, you know, old cars in a pit at the quick lube. And so we realize there's genius. And once you figure out, and for me, everything we went through has been used as a part of where we're going to. I don't think there's wasted time. I think we're putting tools in our little toolbox the whole way along. Every belly flop, stupid decision, wish I would have known better kind of thing has worked out for our good. It's given us a unique perspective.
Have you always, sorry to interrupt, have you always felt that way? I'd love to.
No, I felt like I was getting kicked in the nuts by an NFL kicker all the time. It was like, this is the worst. I can't seem to get ahead. It doesn't seem to work. Everybody else seems to just do anything and it works. But for me, I've got like, I'm on a journey that looks like a detour.
I'd love to dig in a little bit more to that moment when you flip from despair to hope and what that was for you, you know, in whatever way and depth you're willing to share. But, you know, I know a number of people may at different parts in their journey be feeling similarly. What was that process for you? What was the inflection point for you? And what was kind of the catalyst, you know, if there was a catalyst?
Well, the fact that me and Ash were at that time, we were fighting for custody of our son. We'd both gotten attorneys and we were fighting over the businesses that we had and the kid, Nelson, our son. And it was a nasty divorce we were going through. And the pressure of that just kept pushing me. And you know what I kept thinking? Get a new life, get a new wife, get a better tan and a new truck, you'll be fine. That was the plan I had, because I just couldn't see how in the world this old relationship could ever I mean, I hated her as much as I'd ever hated anyone. And in the midst of this, my business partner, how I found out about it is he had tried to get my wife to be with him after being in business together 5 or 7 years. And then when she wouldn't, he had had her followed and gave me the information. That's how I actually found out. And so my business was falling apart while my life and my wife was falling apart while I was hooked on meth. So the combination of this perfect storm of things drove me to the end of myself. And one of the takeaways from that is I think we change when it hurts too bad and costs too much, when we know enough we want to, or when the pain of changing is less than the pain of staying the same. Each of those are a good place. And for me, that's what happened. I got to the end of myself. And through again, I've never met anybody that had the experience I've had. And so I don't know what to say about that. I just felt like I got struck by lightning. And for almost 2 hours, the pain and suffering that drove me to be up there with the rope fixing to hang myself was pushed out of me from the bottom of my feet to the top of my head like a syringe. But I'll tell you what came in and what always has the power is hope for the future. Like I began to believe. I began to think all of a sudden, same circumstances, just as pregnant as I was before with all this mess, I began to believe. I think good Lord's going to heal my marriage. I'm like, you're an idiot. I mean, your wife is saying somebody, you are an idiot. I said, well, nobody gets himself in this shape if they're not an idiot. You don't get $99,000 overdrawn. You don't get $1.5 million in debt, and you don't get as screwed up as I am. I mean, I was messed up as a Chinese phone book. And I said, so I know I'm screwed up, but I need help. But what happened, I met this lady. And you know what I've learned about hope? Hope is a bridge, okay? So I met a lady. We were in the automobile business at this time. And imagine building totals. I said, think about being a wrecked car salesman and then a wrecked used car salesman, and you get an idea of the kind of situation I was in. It's not easy living here. I'd show the car 12 times or 20 times to sell it one time. It gave me a master class in selling. I'm just telling you, I'd be praying over them cars. We'd do anything in the world trying to make them things sell, because we'd stick all our money in one of them and then just wait for it to sell. And we had to do it again when we were really broke. So we're really broke. We're in this situation. But what I learned, a lady that we had sold a vehicle to, her car was having some trouble. And she said, can you come over to the house and take a look at it? I went over there and started working on it. She noticed I was downcast. And she said, why are you so sad? This is unlike you. I said, well, my wife and I are getting a divorce. I told her our story. And you know what I expect her to say? Well, man, I can't believe she did that. She said, oh, your marriage can be healed. I thought, oh my gosh, what are you talking about? Are you an alien? She's like, no, no, no. I said, you don't know nothing about this woman. You got this fabulous house with a picket fence, two great looking kids, and a dog that looks groomed like he came out of a show, and your great husband, he's a CEO or whatever. She said, oh, no, no, no. She said, my husband left me for his secretary, and I'm telling you because our marriage was healed. I thought, wow. Whoa. And you know what entered in that day? Hope. And once hope comes in, the power starts. See, if there's hope, I tell you, there's hope for your business today. There's hope for your relationships. There's hope for your health. There is hope across the board. Amen, period. I'm an ambassador of hope, no matter where you are, no matter how screwed up you are. And my thing is, I was recently with one of our buddies, Chris Powers. He had this retreat and I was speaking at it. And I said, I just once want to meet people a bunch more screwed up than me so I can know how all you people feel. Because I'm the most screwed up guy in the past in the room every time. I haven't met anybody that's belly flopped their life like I have. But what happened is little by little, 7 years, we went through counseling and we made payments and we got to zero. And we found one another again. And we fell in love with one another again. And like I said, just celebrated 31 years the other day. And I'm telling you, I'm more incredibly excited about our relationship and the work we're doing than I was the day I met her. I'm telling you, this something lost and found can be more precious than something never lost. Don't be afraid of things breaking. It's part of the process. And so there's beauty in broken things. And her relationship, when she said that, hope entered in. You ever been in a job and you start going, I don't think this is the right job for me? Well, all of a sudden you lose the power to do that job and nothing changed. So there's something about your hope and believing. And I think if you're struggling, Find someone who's been through what you're going through in a way and let them give you hope. Because if you'll get a vision for your future that has hope in it, strength will start coming back in your present to live with it.
There's so much great kind of wisdom that you have earned, I think, and I appreciate you sharing in this. I'd love to hear maybe that process getting back to zero. What was that? That was, you know, kind of putting literal but also emotional deposits in the bank account and work being fueled through this hope.
Maybe we can, you know, do family that, and finance. Like, talk about like what was some of the rebuilding things on the family and what was some on the financial side.
Sure. Yeah, that sounds great.
Family, I didn't know how to love Ash, and our marriage failed because I made a mistress out of my business. I put my wife in the back seat once she said I do, and I put all my love and care in the business. And as long as she was going along with that and didn't get in the way, that was fine. But I did not love her and show her how her value and priority. So if you're doing that, there's a good chance your marriage or your relationship's going to go mammary glands up. I can promise you that. If you don't do good, it's going to, you can't straddle this thing. It's like a barbed wire fence. You got to be on one side or the other. But what I first with her is I realized if I couldn't figure out how to love her, I was screwed. Like, how can I get love across the fence to where when I do it, she feels it? Because I'd grab her butt and tell her she's pretty and she didn't think that was so awesome, which is hard for me still to believe because I still think it's awesome. But what she really what she really wanted, I couldn't figure it out. It was like a Rubik's Cube. And so I had I think the best question I ever asked my wife is what helped heal our relationship, which is, what is the one thing I could do to show you I love you that I'm not currently doing? The number one thing, not 10, but she had 10. Number one. And just that fast, you know what she said? Don't throw sweaty socks on the floor inside out. I hate it. And I thought, are you kidding me? I mean, of all the things you could pick.
I can do it.
I mean, I'm like,
there's some hope.
Right. I'm like, I can nail this thing. You know, I thought, I said, you'll never pick another one up, ever. You will never pick one up and you'll never turn them inside out again. I said, because every time you look at that laundry basket, you're going to say, this guy's crazy about it. And it was one little act of love that began the process. Now, I would say this, if you screwed your marriage up, and a lot of you folks listening have, because it's just, I mean, we look, 68% of these things are failing in divorce. How many are suffering and suck of the remaining 32% or whatever? Like 85% of that? I mean, you want a challenge, hold your right hand up and your left hand up and tell me if you can feel all 10 fingers with marriages that you would take what they got if that's what you could have. That you say, your marriage is so darn good, I'd love to have one like it. I tell you, me and Ash can't feel two hands, and we know a lot of dang people. It's very difficult to have an amazing marriage. A marriage that's more than you could dream of. It takes a lot of work. It's more complex than business. Believe me, business is way easier than this. So when your thing's having problems, it's like an automatic transmission. I don't know many of y'all can fix those. They're very complicated. Your marriage is more complicated. If you're having trouble, get some dang help and make sure the people have lived what they're trying to give. Because I don't want no people can't swim teaching me how to swim, or fat people teaching me in the gym, right? I want people to got what it is. So that's the family side. Maybe it's that one question, just finding a way to get love across the fence. And then Ash and I have helped reconcile 200 broken marriages since we started. And if you want to listen to, you know, Chris Powers or Brent B. Shore's podcast with me, both of those, they talk about the help we gave them in their marriages. And some of the challenges there. That's a whole nother thing. But I would say this, if you have a clearer vision for your business than you do for your marriage, you're failing. And we've got a sophisticated dang plan for our 5 F's, faith, family, fun, fitness, and finance, all 5 of them. And we just say, listen, I mean, what if I ended up rich and good looking and my wife hated me and my kids didn't want to be with me? Or what if it ended up my kids loved me, my business was great, but I was sick? Or what if I had a crisis of faith? And these are what we feel are 5 anchor points. Like if you had to rate yourself 1 to 10 on your faith, your family, your fun, your fitness, and your finance, where would you rate? Well, that's how we kind of start this conversation. So that's what Ash and I did. We've taken all the business tools we built for our companies, and we pulled them down into our marriage. And we run our marriage like a business. use a rocket fuel lens from Visionary Integrator in the and what it did for us is it said we're going to organize our meetings by that, because I used to affectionately call Ash the dream squisher. I said, because every time I have a dream, you squish it. I'll be like, I want to do this. I'm dreaming this. He's like, how are you going to pay for it? Who's going to insure that? What about this? I'm just like, nobody gets pregnant without excitement, and you're killing mine. I said, every time I tell you my ideas. And so what I did is stop visioning with her. I just said, I'll do promiscuous visioning. I'll vision with other people on my team and other leaders, and then I'll come back to you with a finished plan that I'm going to sell your butt on, and you're going to either get a restraining order or do it. It was not a really good way to do it. So what Ash and I did took 5 years for me to go back and say, I tell you what, you're going to be my only vision partner. Number one, first vision partner. I'll go to others, but only after me and you are aligned. Because I realized the difference in vision and division is two visions. I'll give you an easy thing. If you want to know if your wife and you got division or not, just take your little index card and write down, we got $1, $1 million, or $10 million at the end of the year left. What's your number one, number two, and number three priority? And then let your wife do it and hold them two together and see what they look like. We ain't never seen them the same if they ain't been working on it. And that's something simple like money, right? So that's in marriage. Get a vision for your marriage. We use the rocket fuel. So it's a Google sheet that the top part is integrator. And so it's got the top six priorities for the week. It's got each of our companies. It's got our family. It's got our prayers. Everything we steward, the details. There's tasks and there's links. And that's how we manage that. And then the bottom section is vision. So Ash is the integrator in our marriage. She's the thinker, logical thinker. I'm excitable feeler, which is shifted. Most 75% of all men are thinkers and 75% of all women are feelers. Well, I'm more wired like a woman than I am a man in that way, which is interesting and strange. But what it means is I don't know what I think till I say it, okay? I have to whiteboard with someone else, hear myself say it, take it in, go get alone, and either have peace or concern about it, and it's not clear. Ash, how most men work, think of all the data and details, they collect it. They go get alone and sort that data and come up with a plan that they believe in, and they come back to the world with next steps, right? I don't come back to the world with next steps like that. People like me come back to the world with a compelling vision and a sense of peace. And so if you're one of those leaders that leads by peace or concern, you're going to have to work really hard to help the people with the details build a bridge. So me and Ash are quite different than that. But the last section is my favorite, and it's vision. And all that section is, I write crazy ideas. Like one recently, and I'll tell you, she always laughs at this one. I said, baby, I think you're hot as fire. And I said, I tell you what, why don't you get your massage license and your pilot's license? I said, if you did this, you could give me like massages and you could fly us places. This would be amazing. And she was like, I do not want another job. Thank you, but no thank you. But it was an idea. But what we do in that vision section is all she does really, we'll change locations. Instead of sitting at the counter working on our laptops, we'll go for a walk. We'll sit outside. And really all she says is, tell me more. Interesting. Tell me more. And she says, if she listens to me 3 or 4 meetings and it's something that keeps coming up, you know what she'll say? She'll say, can I ask some clarifying questions about that? Is that healthy enough for me to put a little critique on it? But she doesn't do it until we get to that stage. And this is what's helped us. We consider that provisional talk, brainstorming. No idea is a bad idea. When it moves from that, it moves to plan, which means we're going there. We just don't know how. And then if it moves to the final stage, it's promise. Come hell or high water, we gave our word. We're signing the documents. And see, I talk almost 80% provisional. And my team and my wife speak about 80% promise. And you can imagine how much heated fellowship that causes in between.
This is fascinating. So how did you come up with that framework of thinking about it? Is that something
that a friend of mine, Steve Cockrum, and his company Giant Worldwide, a leadership, came up with it. And we use, so when we're evaluating, and I know we're hopping around, forgive the ADD, folks. It's just hold your hands up. But but like what we realized is that we were investing into projects and we should have been investing into leaders, into people. And so what we began to do is personality tests all the leaders, okay? So we use Enneagram, And we believe it teaches us what average, healthy, and unhealthy perspective or personality is. It lays those out as a low-resolution lens. We use my friends, the giant company's five voices as our communication lens. That's based in Myers-Briggs. And then we use two others, which is the positivity quotient, PQ, and it's positiveintelligence.com is the site, and it's free. And then we use the last one is an old school thing written in a book called Get Motivated. And it's a motivation quotient. And I like it because the thing actually pulls like new rope. I mean, it's not that complicated, but it works. And it's really DNA, desires, needs, affirmation. So my desire is either for production or connection. My need is for variety or stability. And my affirmation is either public or private. So mine, which sounds a little self-serving, but mine is I'm more connection over production. I'm more variety over stability. And I'm more affirmation publicly more than privately. So what motivates me is to connect with people, not have to do the same thing every day, and to be praised in public. The exact opposite is most of my team, leadership team. They want production over connection. They want stability over variety, and they want private affirmation instead of public. So I continuously, with a passion, demotivated most of the people around me for an extended period of time, like years and years and years and years. I mean, like you eat sardines every day and you're just tearing people up and you don't know it.
So how did you realize that? Was there a point when you realized that?
I read this book and went to an event they put on, and I said, I was struggling with like, why are the people I care the most about, who are excellent at what they do, demotivated when they're around me? And I realized I was giving what I wanted and not what they needed. And we don't see the world as it is. We see it as we are. And until we can get a little bit of witnessing ourselves and get back from that a little bit and ask ourselves, what's it like to be on the other side of John? If you're giving motivation and it's not working, it's a dead horse. Put more smelling salts on it, or new saddle, or get a better whip. You got to change the plan.
This is great. That was kind of the path of getting back to zero and then a little bit more. But tell me.
So we got back to zero and we're broke as fire, dumb, don't have any money, got a little bit of experience because we had a public proctology exam that took like 7 years, you know. And every time I go into a bank, all I can think is they think I'm that guy still, right? And so I had to learn to be different. I had to learn to approach it different. And one thing we learned is that we had gifts in seeing beauty in broken things. That's the power of what we do today. Most everything we do has a sense of redemption to it. And remember, in your marriage and in business, try to give it as much time to straighten it out as you spent messing it up. If you messed your marriage for 10 years, don't think you got 10 days to straighten the thing out. It's like a big tree. You got to cut it a piece at a time. So you have to redo this thing. It takes time. The same thing with business. When businesses go sideways, it takes time, right, to rebuild them, just to reboot. So with our business, what we began to do is we began to see what we were doing with audio in the beginning, what I was, and what we did with salvaged cars and parts. We began to say, oh, well, houses are the same way. So we started renovating houses. I had 15 houses going. I was picking up, didn't have any crew, so I'd go by work release and pick up the guys at the work release thing at 5 a.m., take them back at 5, and nobody's laying out on you, I promise, because they don't want to stay in there. And we're fixing up houses. I had 15 jobs going, and my city came to me and said, whoa, you ain't got any license, buddy. I said, sorry, didn't know I was supposed to. So I had to go take my builder's license and got that going. And I started disassembling and moving and reassembling historic houses all the way up to like 8,000 square foot. We'd take them apart to the boards, move them, put them back together. I didn't know I couldn't. We didn't know we shouldn't. Nobody told us. So we just did that for a while.
You would move them or you'd rebuild, you'd refurb them?
Build them backwards. Think the last thing that went in was the first thing we'd take out. We'd take out the trim. We'd take out the plaster. We'd take and number all the studs and the siding, pull the siding off, and then it's roof and a set of framing. It's a pre-cut framing package with doors, floors, and trim. And so we did that. And then we got into, and I was renovating and doing this. We're doing fixed pricing. and guaranteed timeframes renovation. And one of my mentors, that's another subject. My oldest mentor's 83 and been mentoring me 28 years. My second one's 26 years. And then the young ones are 10 years or so. So we've been blessed to have incredible mentors. But they said, well, John, if you keep doing this, the mentor did at the time, he said, now you look at the kind of guys that's working on these houses. He said, do you want the number of teeth they got? They got like three Tempe spares on the truck and look at their life and their wife. You want that? I said, no, sir. He said, well, you better start keeping some of these things in. Stop just doing them for other people. So we started keeping a little bit of property. And so over time, me and my wife have done 300 properties in 10 blocks in our city. Wow. And we still, our portfolio still has 200 properties in it that we steward in these 10 blocks. And we took all these gifts and have found a way to use them in service of saving our city and building something great. 60 businesses, 300 renovations. And then people started calling us from all over America and said, well, how do you do this? We're like, no clue. We don't know. Can you do it again? Not sure. We didn't know how to do it the first time. We just got up every day and tried hard. And all of a sudden, I mean, with real estate, over time, things can really work. It's a powerful long-term and a very difficult short-term strategy. And so we were opening all kinds of operational businesses inside of these because I had like what I called a rent-a-dream program. I needed rent and people had a dream. So we'd launch stuff. And I mean, it was, we heard a lot of young people and hurt ourselves through that because I didn't know what a good deal looked like or a good guy or a good gal. And you can't make a good deal with a bad guy. And it's really hard to make a bad deal with a good guy.
Can you describe a little bit about the ecosystem? You know, so you had these properties, but then it sounds like there's kind of an ecosystem that grows around it. Yeah, how did that ecosystem grow?
Well, it starts as opportunity, I think, in our mind, and then it moves to a portfolio mindset. And we say the third piece to that is a platform mindset. From opportunity to portfolio to platform, like we view all of our companies and our property as a platform to impact our community, to work at the intersection of purpose and profits, to do good and do well. And see what we believe that we don't see much. First, we haven't seen many husband and wife teams work side by side for a lifetime and love it. I mean, like be really dang excited about it. That was number one. We wanted to do that because Ash said, I didn't marry you to be away from you. I married you to be with you. And so we believed that. But then secondly, we began to realize that stewardship of buildings, the business of buildings and making them better only worked if you had great entrepreneurs inside of them because real estate runs on rents. And the best way we found to do it is to bring a young entrepreneur in and us match them with risk and reward. And what we do, like if we're going to start, say, the projects we work on for clients and ourselves, we'll build a performer for the operating business first, and we'll ask ourselves, can they make a life-sustaining wage and be successful at this? Before we talk about how much does it cost, to where does the capital come from, all that other stuff, we start with the customer, who's the entrepreneur, and we build a model they can win at, and then we share percentage base as they're successful because we know their margin. And so if it's a restaurant, we may start with a very simple break even and say, I tell you what, it's 5% of gross up to a certain point, and then it's 8, and then it's 10. Because in the restaurant business, the first million has a little money in it. Second has a good bit more if it's run right. The third, it starts getting exponential. And so what we want to do is align with the success of our entrepreneurs and be their most trusted partner. Like, oh, you know, if we had a patio off of this, I bet the sales would go up. Great. Let's put a patio on there. We'll take care. I mean, we work together. And that's what we learned is that viewing a historic downtowns like complex mixed-use development with fractional ownership. And so now we steward, like you said in the intro, about $2 billion worth of redemptive real estate in 12 small towns for people we call patrons, which are people who love a place and have committed themselves to a place, special investors who are willing to live within their investment and live with it and love it in a place. And so we're uniquely equipped because we are patrons. I mean, we don't just, you know, stand in the stands and holler at the people with the pads on. We're on the dang field in our city, which gives us empathy. And we've learned a lot and done it with our own capital. We've never taken outside capital. So that gives us authority.
So a patron would be that restaurant entrepreneur or someone who's, you know, looking to do something.
Someone who's set more like who were willing to steward a whole, like one of our patrons in Illinois just bought 40 buildings. That's $4.5 million, 250,000 square foot. The town was totally dead. And we'll turn that into something that will create incredible social, spiritual, and economic capital. That's how our model works. And so we'll turn it into something that does good and does well. It should work at the intersection of purpose and profits in a way most people can't even understand, because we measure both and it's woven in the system. Like, again, I sure wish I would have had somebody else's models. I mean, that took forever to get a model. And then I also wish people would have told me you could have raised money, because I didn't know it. I thought you either had to borrow it or have it. I didn't know there was any other system for the longest time. So this was not clear to us. We were just heads down working.
Well, sometimes that leads to good outcomes, and it feels like you all earned a great outcome and continue to build towards that. So I know we've talked about that hometown for you, but where is it and what are some of the other towns that you all have been involved in?
It's Opelika, Alabama is our town. Think Hopelika. Opelika, we're on the I-85 corridor. We're an hour and 15 minutes south of Atlanta Airport, and we're about 6 miles from Auburn University. It's a historic railroad town that was dead. And as I said, we've done over 300 renovations in 10 blocks. We've focused on a very small area, which has worked out very good for us now, because every great thing we create creates a halo effect over everything we steward. So every time we launch a new restaurant, or like we're in the process, we've got north of $63 million worth of development going right now on two sites in our downtown. And all of that is going to add to everything we have because it's all in the same place. Now, we didn't know if this worked at scale, and our smallest town now is 800 people and our largest is about 180,000. I think the Winter Haven, Florida is our best example of what may be possible at scale. Like, we believe we're creating a new asset class of real estate. We've seen commercial real estate. We've seen residential real estate where people own their 10,000 residential homes. We think sophisticated development with love of historic downtowns can be an asset class. We call it irreplaceable real estate, built by people who don't live anymore, with methods we don't do anymore, and entitlements we can't get approved anymore, and methods that we can't do anymore. It's amazing. And when you layer sophisticated programming over it, it's incredible. And we tell people the system doesn't show us this. Like, for example, you take a sheetrock box built a few days ago with an 8-foot ceiling and some crappy shingles on it and vinyl siding, and it's 4,000 square foot. Or you take a 4,000 square foot 1800s building, the solid masonry wall that I can't build for $1,000 a foot, and they have the same rent. They have the same value. Mm-mm. That's the bankers trying to get us on that thing. Because if you're going to be a generational steward like we do, we ask ourselves, what could we do for the good of our city that would last 50 years and no one be able to undo it? When we find that, that's what we go big on. And so what we say, Winter Haven is a $200 million portfolio. It's our largest portfolio that we work with and that we're partnered in. We own about 80 blocks of downtown Winter Haven, a good portion of it. And we raised $80 million from 60 locals as a company. And we were alongside them. And it's interesting to see people invest in an investment that they live in. It's quite a unique experience to see your money building hotels and restaurants and multi. It's just all around. It's improving what you care about. And we found local capital very favorable, that people have a heart when they can live in it and have a longer time frame that they're willing to give the horizon of their money, you know? And so that portfolio is really unique because we've created things to deal with liquidity. It's got annual redemption of $1 million for anyone who wants to redeem their shares. We've had shares sell between individuals. So it's really, in my lens, given me some idea of a resilient community development fund and what's possible in that space, where most of our clients haven't done it at that scale. Like, we either have people who are doing like us, who have borrowed to get there. We had no cash, so we leveraged everything for as long as we could in the beginning, and that's how we got going. I mean, it was, and with very little money, we would go find junky stuff and lease purchase it, put our repairs on it, get it rented up and stabilized, go borrow the money out and do it again. And we're just 60% of our portfolio was originally in a lease purchase option format when we got it, because it allowed us to access a tremendous amount of capital at a very good terms, and we were solving their problems. We don't dicker about price. We say, give us your price, and if we can do it, we'll do it. And if not, and most people, if they say no, they come back, because we only buy problems. We want stuff nobody wants. Like, if you can't put it on the market a year and nobody make an offer, it ain't our stuff.
Well, there's in that, there's opportunity, right?
And that's for us. We love, we think problem solving is like the deal. It's where we can gain and use our gifts in a unique way to get things. And so if your business is solving problems and you're good at it, more than likely, you're going to have a lot of people, won't you?
I've got so many questions, but I also want to make sure I'm respectful of your time. I had three questions that I jotted down that I wanted to pick your brain on. One was, you'd mentioned gifts and giftings. I'd love to understand more what that means to you and how you've kind of incorporated that and what and how you've built.
It's a little difficult, honestly, because like me and Ash, and my wife was the hardest one to work with on this. For me, it kind of, and I don't think it's like one and done. For me, it's revealing itself more and more. But I realized my purpose because it had unique favor on it. Okay. So like, imagine if you look back to your 8 and 10 year old self, what were you successful at? It's the same thing you're using today in a different form. It was underneath all the gifts you have. You know, the gift is underneath the stuff. It's not I'm good at real estate or I'm good at this. For me, there's four things that when I do it, it's disproportionately successful. When I help people grow personally, love God passionately, do good work purposefully, or live intentionally, it's like little rocks in a shepherd boy sling. That thing is going to do amazing stuff. That's what I'm built for. And I've learned that over 30 years of business. I didn't know that. But my own personal gifts. Now, my wife, we would ask ourselves this one thing to be mindful of when your spouse gets to the end of if they're staying at home or they're primary and raising the children, one day the job will close that they have devoted their life to and there's no more access. That's devastating. Imagine us as entrepreneurs saying, oh, can't be an entrepreneur no more. We don't do that. Oh, gosh, what am I going to do?
Yeah.
Well, that's what happens to them. And what Ash and I decided 3 years before that happened is, no. Let's figure out how you want to use all these gifts you've been happened to using as homeschooling and CEO of our home. What are you going to use them for? And finally, she came and said that her gift is actually, we believe her gift is hospitality. And her definition of hospitality is, I thought of you before you got here. And so she does that in everything she does, accounting, design, you name it. And so what she said is, I've been thinking of this, John, for years, and I think I can make our companies more resilient and stabilize them more than you ever have if I had a chance to lead them. And so I 5 years ago, I stepped out of the way as CEO. She stepped in and she's running everything and I'm a support.
Wow.
And she's done infinitely better than I could ever have dreamed of. I mean, not even in the same stratosphere.
Teamwork makes a dream work.
I mean, we're on the same team. We want the same thing. And so, and she's got gifts in that. And so your gift is underneath what you think it is. Go back to your 8-year-old, 10-year-old self and start asking, what was that guy or gal successful at? Gifts in there. You got to see a golden thread through all you do. Ash had 30-something jobs over her lifetime. I mean, from cooking 100 different flavors of popcorn to running a shoe store, it's in every one of them.
What's next? We talked about opportunity, portfolio, platform. Are you all thinking about, it sounds like platform. You're effectively a platform at this phase. What gets you excited? What are you and Ash when you're sitting around the dinner table or having a glass of wine or having fun and getting excited, brainstorming together? What are you guys talking about and dreaming up together?
A dream that we originally had in 2006. It died, had again in 14, it died, had again in 19, it died. So we're talking a 17-year dream that will not die. Well, it's happening. And so we're building what we've dreamed of, a urban resort, diffused hospitality resort in our downtown with 8 restaurants, 60 boutique hotel rooms, and 3 event spaces on one 7-acre site that will be the transformative model we use for everything we do in the future. And I'm so excited. I mean, I feel like a mosquito in a nudist colony. Opportunity everywhere. This is what we've been preparing our whole lives for. And one of the magic of this, think about this, is what could you do and build in a small town of 4,000 or 5,000 people that could generate 150 jobs and be worth $50 or $60 million? And we figured it out. Now, we ain't that smart. It only took 25 or something years to get to here, but we did each part of this for our clients and for ourselves. And when it all came together, we realized that the power of influence of community, if you can build a resort, is unbelievable. These diffused resorts. So imagine it's scattered over different buildings and things. And but it's the mindset of a resort that allows you to roll operational income into real estate rents.
How does that work? I don't even know what that means.
It's just kind of scattered. So think about, you've been to hotels where there's a tower and it's got 10 stories and you get in the elevator. Well, you ever been to a place that had like a bed and breakfast and it had like a cottage here and a cottage there and a little house? That's diffused. Imagine scattering a hotel resort across a town, a downtown. It's got 60 rooms, but it's scattered. Now, we're scattered on a 7-acre campus, but we're going to do this throughout downtowns too. But the magic is this. So if a business is a great business, I don't know you guys, I'm not private equity, and I don't know anything about that world, honestly, to speak of, other than you're hanging out with y'all smart guys. I'm hoping some will rub off. But but it's this idea that imagine you had a business with $1 million worth of income. And maybe in private equity, it's worth 3 to 5 times earnings, right? If it's a complex thing and you're wrestling porcupines all the time. Well, imagine rolling all that income, 80% of that, up into real estate rents. And now it's at a 6 cap. It's a whole different ballgame. And so that's what we realized, that we launched restaurants all over America in service of saving cities. We've launched these boutique hotels and event spaces. With them all together, it's a diffused resort. And capital understands the resort income model. And that allows us to roll all that up. And so the average one of these will probably do $17 to $20 million top line in a town of 2,000 or 3,000 or 5,000. You say, where are the people coming from? Not that town. I mean, you're getting them to come to it, not through it. You got to be so dang good, people will show up. Nobody goes to a city, man, had the best time of my life. What'd you do? Had Ruby Tuesdays. Nobody says that. Their goal is to disappoint you at a rate you'll stand. If you're going to have an amazing experience, you had an iconic restaurant, you have fabulous food and beverage, and you had amazing overnight stay. That stuff, every city can be one great experience from a destination.
The beauty of that is you're also building more density and more pull to that,
and
to
jobs,
that spot.
We're high paying all of the jobs. I mean, and it's, there's a lot more to it. I'm so excited about that. But the model is that we believe historic downtowns viewed like complex mixed use developments is the future of small towns that are dying. Secondly, we believe we can produce tons of economic, social, and spiritual capital by these diffused resorts. And again, we're doing it with our own money. Come and see. We're not saying, hey, you ought to do this. We're saying we're doing this. Come look. The water's good. Come get in.
Yeah, the beauty to it, in addition to creating density, is you guys are playing to your gifts and what you're passionate about. It's hard not to win if you're doing that.
Again, it isn't how much it'll make. We're just dang excited to get to do it.
That's awesome. Well, let me know when the rooms are open and you need someone to come visit. I'd love to come check it out.
Our first 7 rooms come online in about 3 weeks. So we starting out, and it's going to be amazing. First restaurant launches next year. Well, 3 restaurants, actually, which will import wines from the Piedmont region of Italy. Well, the smallest batch wines from the Piedmont. It's going to be incredible. I mean, again, if it doesn't blow your socks off, we totally missed it. It ought to be one of the most memorable experiences of your life.
That's awesome. John, I appreciate you taking the time. This has been amazing. We've known each other and had many conversations, but I always learn something new. So I appreciate you spending the time with me. I'm going to ask you the same kind of closing question I ask everyone. It's a 2-part question, and it's kind of goofily modeled after the take a penny, leave a penny dish at a convenience store. But I'll ask you what one thing would you, if you had to leave a penny, what one thing would, as either a piece of advice or a book or a tip or something that's been helpful to you what would you leave with the audience, you know, as they're thinking about, you know, either what they're currently building or what they're aspiring to build? And then the second part of that question will be the flip of that. What one thing could the audience be helpful for you and Ash on something you're working on or something you're passionate about?
Well, the leave something would be that you can't manage what you don't measure. The miracle formula we use is measure, manage, multiply. Whatever you measure, you can manage. And whatever you manage, we believe the good Lord will multiply. And one thing I think that's so difficult is for entrepreneurs and guys who have all this going on. And I know there's a thousand reasons why you don't do everything you want to do, or I don't do everything I want to do. But it's the daily disciplines. It's the magic. And if I'm going to leave you something, I'm going to say evaluate your daily discipline, because they will tell you where you're going to end up. Your decisions are directions. And so I know if I go spend 2 or 3 weeks with a man or lady and watch how they live, I know where they're going to end up. You don't plant corn and get apples. You don't smoke 3 packs a day and it knock. Everything you're doing daily is the magic. It's not working toward the magic. That is the magic. So document your daily disciplines and know what you're doing. Do it on purpose, or either do it intentionally or you're doing it accidentally.
That's great. And I could certainly, I think, learn from that, but I'm sure many others could too. Thank you. If there's one thing that our community could help you with, what would that be?
I mean, if there's anything I'm praying for today is winners. I need good people whose heart resonates with this message. The work is so big and the workers are so few. I mean, I love the ancient scripture says this. It says the harvest is plentiful, it's the workers is few. And we want to transform 100 small towns in the next 10 years. And we're trying to complete a book that's the operating system to this. I'm not saying we're going to do them all, but buddy, I tell you one thing, I'm throwing wood on the fire of getting people excited about doing something that allows them to transform generations if it's done right.
Is there a web, where can folks reach out to you, or
Marsh Collective.com?
Okay.
MarshCollective.com is our website. There's some great tools on there. If the 5Fs have struck you any, there's a, in our couples section, there's a free 5F couples assessment that has added tons of value. It makes you codify stuff. Like, I mean, how am I doing here, honey? 1 to 10. Well, 2s aren't good. You know, and so well, how can I move from a 2 to a 3, you know, and how I can get a little better. And so there's some great couples things. You can check out our Redemptification podcast. It's more crazy stuff like you've heard here from me, just trying to add value. And then if you ever want to see Opelika, come and see. If you don't know that it has divine favor on it, we missed it. It ought to look so dang good. You say, because I tell people, I say, you're going to think we're geniuses and then you're going to think we're idiots. And we're neither. We're in between.
This has been awesome. Thank you, John. You shared a lot of thoughts and wisdom that I think will benefit many people. So thank you for taking the time, and I appreciate the conversation.
Thank you. I like you a lot, and I admire your integrity and the way you go about things and how intentional you are. And I'm grateful to be on here.
Well, I owe you a beer for saying that. I'll pay you after. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. We hope you enjoyed the episode. To join the Built to Outlast community and access episodes, show notes, and other community resources, please visit builttooutlast.com. If you have or know a business that may be sold and care who the buyer is, or want to build a business and care who you do it with, please visit enduring.co to learn more about us, our long-term approach, and our holding company.